The following is an interview which I conducted with Dr. Oliver Jenrich of the European Space Agency about the LISA Pathfinder mission. It was originally broadcast as part of the November issue of the Jodcast. For the full issue of the Jodcast, please go to www.jodcast.net. Okay, today with me is Dr. Oliver Jenrich from the European Space Agency. Thank you very much for coming with us and being with us today. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and the research that you do.
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to be here. It's a great honor to be here in this great place, actually. Never been here before, so it looks very nice. So my job at the European Space Agency is the project scientist for a space-based gravitational wave detector, LISA. And in general terms, a project scientist is the interface between the scientists in the academic world and the engineers in the agency that eventually will build or supervise the building of the satellite.
Okay, so you're pretty much the go-between, I suppose, between the technicians, the academics, and everybody else, I suppose. You're in charge of the whole project overall. Is that true?
Well, not quite. So for the project itself, the project responsibility, we have project managers that interface between science, engineering, and industry. So those are the people who do really the screaming and the kicking to make sure that everything is on time. My job is more along the lines of making sure that when the scientists want to have a mission that should deliver some sort of science, that we safeguard the mission against schedule pressure and budget pressure and make sure that industry and the engineers do understand what it's meant when scientists say, oh, we want to have that sensitivity in this frequency band. How can we translate that into operational scenarios and architecture of the mission?
Okay, and now, so the project that we're talking about here is LISA. Tell us a little bit about the LISA mission.
So LISA is an acronym standing for the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, and it's a bit contrived. So people say jokingly that that probably comes from the first name of the eldest daughter of one of the principal investigators. And I don't quite know how true that is, but certainly her name is LISA as well, so that might be true. But what we are doing there with that mission is we try to detect and observe gravitational waves. Now, gravitational waves are something that have long been predicted by not only general relativity, but by any serious contender for a theory for gravity, because whenever you have a finite speed of light, you effectively end up with waves and gravitational waves as well. So Einstein predicted them in, I think, 1918. He thought a bit of that as a mathematical curiosity. He's reported to have said, well, you know, they are there, but they will never be detectable because they are way too weak. And it took another 40 years before then Hermann Bondi discovered that, oh, yes, they could be detectable because there are objects out there that produce very, very strong gravitational waves. For example, black holes coalescing with other black holes, two galaxies colliding and the cores of the galaxies coalescing, sending out a huge amount of signal. So in essence, we are trying to detect these waves and to open a new field of astronomy, really.
I guess a question which may not be particularly easy to answer, for a gravitational wave, what's doing the waving?
That is actually It's a kind of a tricky question, because typically you get the mathematics to that and you look at it and say, oh, yeah, there's the wave. If you want to imagine what's going on, the usual picture people have in mind that work in that field is, imagine you have a ring of masses and a gravitational wave passing by. What will happen is that that ring will be stretched and squeezed to a sort of an oblong shape. And what's oscillating there is really space-time itself. So we always say gravitational waves change the distance between masses or distance between different points in space-time. And this is what we really want to measure.
So in the same way that water waves are waves in water, you can see them propagate through. They have a certain amplitude and direction and what have you. Gravitational waves are waves actually of space-time itself, as you say. So you detect it through how? Through changes in what?
Well, there are different concepts. So how we do it, or how we plan to do it, we want to measure the change of distance between two points in space-time directly. And a common and very well-proven way of doing that is to use interferometric measurement. If you're going out in the field seeing surveyors trying to plot a new road or something like that, many of those measurements are nowadays done interferometrically. So it's a very natural thought to do that with gravitational waves as well. Unfortunately, gravitational waves have a very, very small effect. So the typical effect is something like changing the distance between the Sun and the Earth to the diameter of a few atoms. And you have to really measure very accurately to do that. And one way of doing that is you need to measure a very, very long distance so that the changes are not as tiny anymore. And the concept we are looking at is having a measurement baseline of 5 million kilometers. And it's obvious that you can only do that in space. Having said that, there are, of course, ground-based interferometers as well and ground-based detectors as well. They are, some of them, working in the same way, measuring distance interferometrically. And they are way more sensitive than we will ever be. But they have to be because they have a much shorter baseline. You won't be able to fit 5 million kilometers on ground, of course. So they are typically on the scale of a few kilometers. And the very early concept of taking gravitational waves is just take a lump of mass, wait until the gravitational wave passes by, and listen for the ringing of that mass. And that has been done first by Joe Weber in the early 60s in the United States and in Europe as well. And they delivered an astonishing competence in building very, very sensitive machines. However, their problem is a little bit that nature doesn't provide them with the gravitational wave where they are looking at because their frequency range is a bit out of the place, so it's not really clear if there are sources that emit in this frequency band.
So the key to detecting these gravitational waves is to measure a distance very, very accurately. So how do you use interferometry to do this?
Well, this is a very simple part of it, because what you do is you just send light one direction and send light another direction, say 90 degrees from it, and you reflect the light at some point so that it comes back to you, and then you compare the phase of the light that comes from one side or the other. So if you're thinking about the crest and the trough of waves, you will see that there's a shift between those, and you can easily see, because of the resulting amplitude, then how much the light in one or the other direction has been shifted. And from that light shift, you infer that the light must have traveled a longer distance.
So you mentioned the frequency of these gravitational waves. What do you learn from the frequency of the gravitational wave? What is a typical frequency for a gravity wave, which we will get from the sort of astrophysical phenomena that you expect?
The frequency band for LISA is really from roughly 30 microhertz to a hertz, something like that. So if you, at that frequency ranges, it might be better to think about timescale. So timescale between a second on the high frequency range and a few thousand to 10,000 seconds in the low frequency range. And in the low frequency range, we are mainly expecting coalescing supermassive black holes. And the reason why they are so low frequency, if you have a mass of 10 to the 8 solar masses, it's almost impossible to move much faster than that. So these are very, very massive objects that cannot move as quickly. So you're bound to have very, very low frequencies there. And on the high-end side, there are effects like smaller neutron stars or smaller black holes falling into these big black holes, or neutron star binaries and black hole binaries that just keep orbiting each other and emitting gravitational waves.
Okay, right. Now tell us a little bit about the LISA mission itself. How is it going to work?
With LISA, we will have three satellites in an orbit around the Sun. These three satellites form an equilateral triangle with 5 million kilometer distance to each other, and they will be roughly 20 degrees or 50 million kilometers behind the Earth. And we have to look into things like, we don't want to have the disturbance effects of the Earth-Moon system to be too large, but we want still be able to communicate with the constellation, so we can't put it really far off. And the mission will then last for a couple of years. Baseline at the moment is 5 years. And light will bounce between the spacecraft. So one satellite through a telescope of moderate size, 40 centimeters, will send light to the other telescope. Now, if you pass a laser beam for 5 million kilometers and you start out with a beam width of 40 centimeters, you still end up with a beam width of 30 to 40 kilometers. So what that means, if you have a light collecting area of 40 centimeter telescope on the other side, you only detect every 10 to the 10th photon or something like that. So there's no way you can just put a mirror there and bring things back, because you will be down to a photon per hour or something like that. And this is not feasible to do a proper measurement with that. So what we do is we borrowed a concept from the radio astronomy people and the radio link people. They use transponders where they detect an incoming radio signal and send out the same signal again, but very much amplified. And this is what we do as well. So we send light to one satellite. It will be there detected. And this satellite has its own laser that sends light back to the first satellite. So in total, we have 6 links, 3 uplinks, 3 downlinks, if you like. We measure the phases of the light that comes in. And then we go into data processing, and we will be able to effectively synthesize the response of all the interferometric combinations there. So we have the great advantage that we, in contrast to the old Michelson-Morley experiment where they really detected power, light power, we can really detect the amplitude and have the accuracy increased by that tremendously.
The whole concept is based on being able to measure the distance between your co-flying satellites to an extraordinary accuracy, which you can do with the interferometry. However, doesn't that mean that you need to know the position of these satellites relative to each other to an even higher accuracy? Aren't you going to be possibly fooled by a slight shift between the satellites falling out of formation and think that, oh, that's a gravitational wave? How are you going to get around that?
Yeah, of course, that's a principal problem. However, there are ways around that. The first thing you have to realize is that we are not so much interested in the distance. We are interested in the change of the distance. So we don't care if it's 5 million kilometers or 5 million kilometers and a couple of meters. So there are some technical limitations to that. For some reasons, we need to know the distance to within a few kilometers, but that can be easily done by common ranging techniques that are well understood in the space industry. So that can be done. Now, but we are really looking to the change of the distance. And you're right, if we want to measure that, we have to make sure that no other sources or other movements in that frequency range where we are looking at it disturb us. So what we really need to do, we need to provide a very, very quiet environment on timescales between a second and, say, 10,000 seconds. And the way we do that is we do not just put spacecraft into orbit, because if we do that, we have to fight radiation pressure from the sun and particle emitted from the sun and coupling to interplanetary magnetic fields and all that. What we do is we take a little cube, a mass cube of a gold platinum alloy, and put that into orbit and have the spacecraft shielding it. So there is in the belly of the spacecraft, you like, there is a little gold cube that the spacecraft then monitors. So the spacecraft follows that gold cube, and all the onslaught of light and radiation and all that will hit the spacecraft, but not the little gold cube. So the little gold cube will be as much as possible in a purely gravitational orbit. Of course, you'll never be able to do that because you have gravity gradient forces and all that. But it's really the technology challenge here is to do that as good as possible.
I see. So the little gold cube at the center of the spacecraft is
the standard for the orbit. Basically, the satellite will follow whatever that little gold cube does. So the little gold cube is being shielded from all the particles and all the nasty stuff coming from the solar environment. It's purely a gravitational thing. So the spacecraft presumably will use its thrusters to keep itself away from, well, keep the gold cube from hitting the inside of the spacecraft, presumably.
Absolutely true. If you don't control the spacecraft, sooner or later, the spacecraft will hit the gold cube. So the spacecraft is equipped with thrusters that are very, very finely adjustable on the level of a few micronewton and less. So we are using a relatively recent technology development for that, where we use ion drives that have a very, very low thrust capability, but on the same time are very, very finely tunable, so that we can very precisely steer the spacecraft. And we are talking about micronewton forces here, really. So the acceleration that's on the spacecraft is very, very low indeed, but that's all what's needed.
Right, okay, so what's the next step? When does LISA fly? Is there still work to be done, or is this all in progress? When's it going to happen?
In the space business, things unfortunately do not only depend on technology and scientific merit, there's a huge amount of budgetary pressure as well. So in addition to that, we have a Pathfinder mission, aptly named LISA Pathfinder, which is supposed to test exactly those principles of this little gold cube and the spacecraft following it and the micronewton thrusters and the according control law. And that is at the moment in implementation, so hardware is built and it will be launched by the end of 2009, maybe early 2010, but at the moment we are looking at end of 2009. And LISA will then be at the current plans for LISA show probable launch date in the area of 2016. If you're looking 10 years ahead, there is so much that can happen that no one wants to narrow it down to pretty much better than a year, because it depends on many things that you cannot control at that point of time. But LISA is a mission conducted from the European Space Agency together with the US NASA, and it's a joint mission, so there are joint programmatic issues as well. So in simple words, money has to be there on both sides of the Atlantic.
So let's assume LISA is now flying and taking data, and you see a signal which you think could be a gravitational wave. What do we learn from it? Do we learn what could possibly have caused it? Do we know in which direction that the gravity wave came from?
Well, if LISA is flying and we see a gravitational wave, we open a bottle of champagne, because chances are that we are really still the first one who directly detected. But LISA has directional capabilities. So the main issue here is that LISA goes in orbit around the sun. So depending on where the source is, you see various degrees of Doppler effects. So you can just by observing the blue shift and the red shift in the light or in the gravitational wave, you can find out which direction the source is. There is some directionality in the antenna pattern of LISA as well. So we get a certain angular sensitivity. And for our really big sources, supermassive black holes, we are in the order of a few arc minutes, which means that we can identify a region in the sky where those two host galaxies of that supermassive black hole coalescence should be, and can tell that to the electromagnetic observers to have please a look and see if they can see, if they can find something. Other sources of gravitational waves are less strong, so the angular resolution is less good, so a few degrees maybe, sometimes even worse, but then they are not as far away and the sources are not that abundant. So there's a good chance that for most of our sources we can find an electromagnetic companion, and then you can really do wonderful astrophysics with that, in, for example, establishing an independent distance scale from gravitational redshift and optical redshift, and you can look into what happens really in the early stages of a coalescing event where things are optically not that prominent and they only become prominent much later. when they might or might not send out gamma ray bursts, for example. So actually, we can learn a lot. It's not just sitting there saying, oh, we have gravitational waves. We can do astrophysics. And the nice thing about that mission is that the longer people think about what you can do with the signal, the more fantastic things they find out. And a relatively recent idea was that we can actually, with a bit of luck, determine the Hubble's constant to order of 3% or so, and effectively without any systematic errors. So if that turns out to be true, with a bit of luck, because we need to have some electromagnetic companions there, but chances are that we will be able to find that, or the electromagnetic community will be able to find that. So there's always, at the moment, we have our main science drivers, but there's always people coming up, bright people with good ideas. Oh, we could do that, and we could do that, and we could do that as well. It's the first mission of that kind, so it's bound to happen.
So this is going to be the beginning of a new type of astronomy. This is going to be the beginning of gravitational astronomy, pretty much. So we look forward to the successful flight of LISA Pathfinder, and after that, LISA itself. So thank you very much indeed for coming and talking to us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you as well.